Okay. We're talking with Dr. Elizabeth Ann Segal, who joined the Department of Pediatrics and Human Development in 1971.
Right.
How did that happen?
It happened because I ran into Art Corman at a party.
Okay.
I was finishing up my doctorate,
yeah.
And I happened to be at a social event, and I met Art Corman. And he said, "What do you do?" And I told him. And he said, "We might be able to use somebody like you in our department."
Okay.
So this was before the days of job descriptions and
right.
a lot of paperwork about filing job descriptions. So he said, "Well, send me a CV, and we'll give you a call." So I did that, and I interviewed with Tom Helmrath.
Okay.
Possibly Jim Trosko, I'm not sure. You
yeah.
and Bill Weil, and probably Art.
Mm-hmm.
I think those were about five people that I interviewed with, and everybody was scattered around into different buildings.
Yes.
and I was offered a job starting mm-hmm. that September. So I started on September 15th, even though the plaque on my chair yeah. when I retired says December. It was really September.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
So you were a graduate student at MSU?
Yes.
In
clinical psychology.
Okay. Did you have a particular reason for wanting to stay around Michigan State, or was this a job, and any job is a good job?
Well, I got married that same summer to Art Segal, who was a professor in the Department of Psychology mm-hmm. at Michigan State. So we needed to have two jobs together, and
yep.
we were looking for two jobs together, and we had gone to some other places to look okay. at jobs. So there was a possibility that we might have moved. But Art also had small children that lived in East
yep.
Lansing, and so it was better not to move away from the children. And after all, he already had a job. So, yes, it was good to stay at Michigan State
yeah,
from
okay.
that point of view.
Was moving into pediatrics career continuity or a career shift for you?
Well, I'd done my internship at University Hospitals of Cleveland, where a number of people in the department had ties. Bill and I think Art and some other people, too, had done either medical school, mm-hmm. internship, residency, or been faculty in Cleveland. So there was quite a Cleveland connection. And when I did my internship in Cleveland, I did spend some time doing consultation to medical wards.
Mm-hmm.
So I had that experience. And I also did take extra elective work in pediatrics.
Right.
So it was continuity for me. Actually, when I had started graduate school, I had the idea of working with adults
mm-hmm.
because it was so stereotypic at that time that if you're a woman, of course, you're going to work with children.
Yes.
So my reaction to that was certainly not. but in fact, when I was doing my internship, yeah. the feedback that I got from the supervisors that were supervising my child mm-hmm. work was that I really ought to think about mm-hmm. making this my career
yeah.
because they thought I was very good at it. And I am very fond of children.
He was so. Right. What was your job description?
Oh, you know, I wish I had saved that letter. The official letter inviting yeah. me to join the department that was signed by Bill, it was extremely vague. It was, "You will join the department mm-hmm. and participate in all the activities of the department."
Uh-huh.
So there was really no job description. What we were focused on at that time was very much the shift from the two-year to the four-year medical
right.
school. And very soon on the heels of that was the development of residencies,
mm-hmm.
because we didn't have a residency when I first joined.
Right.
Being a psychologist in a medical school department, the focus really was on the whole education of humane physicians
mm-hmm.
thrust,
mm-hmm.
which was part of the reason for the whole founding of the medical school was to try to make a more well-rounded physician, not just a narrow, biologically
right.
oriented physician, but a biopsychosocially
social.
Oriented physician. And so I was involved right from the beginning in terms of curriculum, how to make the curriculum relevant to medical students and mm-hmm. give them the information that they needed that was psychological in nature, participate in the clinical activities of the department as a way of serving families more fully. And at the time I joined the department, the only clinic that was being run was the genetics clinic.
Mm-hmm.
So I used to...
You participated in that?
I participated in the genetics clinic, which I enjoyed tremendously. Okay. I learned a lot about genetics, and I'm still very interested. It's interesting to me that the training and experience that I got from working in the genetic yep. clinic still stands me in good stead, in that even though I'm retired from the university, I have a small private practice.
Yep.
And when I see young children who have developmental problems, I do take a family mm-hmm. history, not only for the social aspects, yeah. but also for the biological aspects. And I have made several referrals to genetics okay. clinic because I think, this is something that needs something to be looked yeah. into more fully. And it's interesting to me that sometimes I pick up on some things that the referring physician hasn't picked up on the biological side.
Why is that surprising?
Well, and a lot of times it's because I'm really spending much more time with the yep. family than they are in the pediatric appointment. Yep. So, the whole department, as I recall, was involved in genetics clinic, uh-huh. and that was a lot of fun.
There was also a primary care clinic.
Soon after that.
That Seroge ran.
Yes. I don't think I was involved with Seroge in doing primary care, okay. but Ray Helfer joined the department in July of 71.
Right.
So just a couple of months before I joined. Mm-hmm. And he was doing a primary care clinic, and very soon that really became kind of a child advocacy, yeah. child protection kind of clinic. Yeah. When people found out, because he already had a reputation in the area of child protection.
Right.
And so the local agencies began making referrals to him, and so he asked me if I would see those children mm-hmm. with him. And that was a great education for me also, because I really had not had much training in child abuse and neglect mm-hmm. in graduate school. The whole concept was pretty
Nobody
new.
Had.
Yeah, it was a very new yep. concept. So yep. I really learned a lot from working mm-hmm. with Ray. And I still remember some of those cases vividly because mm-hmm. they make a tremendous impression on you.
Mm-hmm. I want to come back to that, but first I want to ask you, before you joined the department, what did you know about the medical school?
Nothing. I'm not sure I even knew there was a medical
okay.
school. You know, when you're a student, you're pretty absorbed
yeah.
in what you need to do for your own education. So I'm not mm-hmm. sure that I was aware that okay. there was a medical school. I knew about the veterinary school.
Yeah. Okay. And when you joined, the department had just moved to life sciences.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And was your first office across from the men's room?
No, that was my second office. My first office was on the third floor in a lab. It was one of those little offices okay. that was off the side of a lab.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think I stayed there very long. I have really only one strong memory of that office, which mm-hmm. was of receiving as part of the office furniture a very large filing cabinet and having one file to put in it, thinking, oh my God, how will I ever fill this?
Mm-hmm.
Now I have the opposite problem.
Yes. I remember saying something about you didn't see why a faculty person could do a perfectly good job between 8 and 5.
And well,
raise children and take care of family.
Yes. I thought it was part of my mission as a psychologist.
Mm-hmm.
in a medical school, which said that it wanted to make more humane physicians,
okay.
to help my colleagues see mm-hmm. that there was a relevance to their own lives and to behaving in a way that was consistent with that.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if you want a psychologist to be there and to talk about psychological things, then one of the things you have to talk about is, well, what are our values here with regard to
right.
work and personal life and family? And that is one of the big pressures, obviously, on physicians
mm-hmm.
traditionally, is not having a family life, not having a personal life, working all the time and valuing work above that. And I thought that was an important aspect of my mission, was to push rather the other viewpoint.
And what happened?
I was not tremendously successful. I did set some limits, but
mm-hmm.
I also made some shifts myself.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I also saw that there is a very strong culture of talking about how hard you're working, regardless of what you might be doing.
Right.
And so that one is not supposed to acknowledge, for example, that one is taking off between 2 and 4 to go play racquetball on a non-clinic day.
Right.
You know, it took me a while to figure out that this sort of thing was happening.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was just listening to what people were saying.
Yes. And seeing them there at 5 o'clock.
Yes. Right.
When one of my first jobs, when I worked in Baltimore for a social agency, I rode the bus, and I carried a briefcase so I'd have something to read on the bus. Everybody at the agency thought I must be working awfully hard because I was taking a briefcase home at night.
Ah. Interesting.
Uh-huh. Impression management.
Yes, yes.
Okay, so which courses did you participate in the first couple of years? Do you remember?
Well, there was a human biology and behavior course. Possibly it didn't have that name, but it was something along those lines.
Right.
And it had been initiated before I got there by John McKinney, who was a developmental psychologist in the psychology department, an anatomist who was an embryologist. I'm trying to think of his name.
Jim Thomas.
Jim Thomas, yes.
Yes.
I think Jim Higgins, the geneticist, may have been involved in teaching that course.
Mm-hmm.
And then some of the pediatricians, I'm not sure who all the pediatricians were, but they were trying to make a biopsychosocial course,
right.
Although I don't think that George Engel coined that term biopsychosocial until a couple of years later. It seems to me his article about that
came out
sometime in the early 70s.
Yep. Dave Klein.
Dave Klein, was he in that too?
He was in that. I was in it.
All right.
Yeah.
So the idea was to try to put together all these bits about human development and make them fit together. But the problem is that all of us are trained in our specialty.
Yes.
So it's very hard to integrate it and to present it to students in an integrated fashion because we work from different models. Mm-hmm. We use different vocabulary. We have different theoretical ideas. I mean, even one of the things that I noticed early on, I was going to write an article about this. I even had an early draft of an article. I never ended up doing this. But one of the things that I noticed is that when you're trained in primarily a research model, a PhD is a research training, you're trained always to speak with caution. You qualify everything you say with things like, the evidence seems to suggest that.
Yes.
Well, our best knowledge at this point is, and all those kinds of things. You constantly qualify what you say in order to keep that mindfulness that we don't have the ultimate truth and we're always working on it, and science is always evolving, and this is our best understanding at this point in time, with the idea that it can be revised. And in a professional education, it appears that you speak with far more certainty than you actually feel. So as a psychologist, I was trained to speak probably with less certainty, and physicians were speaking with more certainty. It took me a little while to figure that out. And one of the ways that this impacted on the teaching of medical students is that the social scientists all seemed to the students like they didn't know what they were talking about. Because we wouldn't come into class and say, here it is, this is it, this is what we know, and this is right. We would make all these qualifying statements. And that's a little different than somebody coming in and saying, here's the anatomy of the heart, you know, here's the left ventricle and the right ventricle, and so on. Well, you can make statements about anatomy with more certainty. So I think that contrast kind of fed the students' suspicion of the social scientists as people that really didn't know what they were talking about. And the different models that we would present. You know, here's so-and-so's thinking on this. Well, here's somebody else's thinking on this. Again, that's our training. Rather than distilling it all to,
this is what you this,
here's
do.
The answer.
Yeah.
This is what you should do. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that that made some of the early teaching really a struggle for all of us.
Yeah. I think also maybe not so much for you, but for some of us, translating what we knew into ways that it would be useful clinically.
Yes.
Was very difficult.
Yes, that's exactly right. And actually, I, realizing that, I began to try to pay more attention to instances that I could use as examples in teaching, both in terms of clinical things that I saw in clinics, but also things I might read in the paper. Because then you can bring that in and say to the students, okay, here's an example.
Yeah.
And work from there. And indeed, eventually that's what I came to. In order to be successful teaching medical students, you have to constantly tie it back into the clinical relevance.
Did you get help from your colleagues in doing this?
Well, not as much as I would have liked. I remember calling OMERED in those early days at some point, I don't remember exactly when, and saying, you know, I would like to have help in learning how to be a better teacher. And you people are involved with medical education, so maybe somebody could consult with me, maybe come and sit in on a class and give me some advice. And they said, do you have a grant to pay us to do that? And I said, no, I don't. And that was the end of that. Now, some of the other teaching, for example, the doctor-patient relationship course, which was the predecessor of clinical skills, that course I also taught, and I had a lot of help because that was set up to train faculty for how to be the preceptor in that course. And I enjoyed that a lot because that was, of course, much more in line with my training. That was about interviewing skills. So that was a lot of fun. I liked doing that.
Did you teach in focal problems?
I did teach in focal problems. And that, how much I enjoyed that had entirely to do with who I was assigned to teach with. If I was with a physician who respected my ability to make a professional contribution, then I would always have a good experience in focal problem because that physician would be the role model for the students. And they would look to that person to set the tone for who the heck was this lady over here and how should she be treated and how should her remarks be regarded. So if I was being treated respectfully by the physician, then I had a great experience. And if I had a physician who thought I was from another planet, I had a less good experience. I can't say that I was ever treated really badly by anyone, but there was a variability in terms of how much they really understood what my role was and what sort of contributions I could make. And of course, those people weren't necessarily from our department. In fact, most of the time they were from other departments, which was fun because it had helped me meet other people from other departments.
So what was the department like when you joined it?
It was young, it was enthusiastic, it was idealistic, it was energetic. People were very excited about this enterprise of developing this new kind of medical school. And that it was a lot of fun to be part of that energy. We were also idealistic in terms of our attitude toward patient care, in that we really didn't care whether anybody could pay, whether they had insurance. I mean, this was before all of that became important. There was no billing personnel who were members of our department. We had, you know, I guess one clerk to check patients in and out. And I suppose there was a billing system early on, but I don't think I was even really very aware of billing in the early days. As soon as we had a residency, we had a clinic down at St. Lawrence, too. I would go to, and I think you went to it, Lou Snow went to it, all the social scientists took turns going to that. I don't know, I think we, at one point, we might have gone every week and taken different days of the week. And then later, went less frequently. But that was a lot of fun because that was a segment of our population that was more needy, more close to the bone in terms of having resources. And we even did some training with residents of making home visits. I remember going to a home visit with Robin Perlow, who was one of our early residents, with one of his families, and how eye-opening that was for him. He really talked about how helpful that had been in terms of finding out what kind of conditions his patients were living in. And very important in terms of what kind of recommendations you can give to patients.
That's right.
You know, do this, take care of this, buy this. Well, maybe not. And it was fun also to work with Lou Snow because she had the whole anthropological perspective of, gee, there's a cultural piece here about alternative medicine, which was also a really new idea at that time, that people from another American subculture might have their own healers who might be giving them conflicting advice, or at least advice that we didn't know about.
Or conflicting medications.
Conflicting medications. Yep. I remember one of her early examples was that the grandmother told the young mother, the teenage mother, that for thrush, you wipe out the baby's mouth with its wet diaper. And it turns out that this, in fact, works because the pH of urine is apparently appropriate for treating thrush. However, it seems rather distasteful.
Yes.
But on the other hand,
the baby didn't know the difference.
And for people that are poor, you know, there's no expense involved with that. But that was a new world to me. I knew nothing about that. That was very interesting.
Yeah. I remember somebody trying to explain to a resident that you don't give a medication that needs to be kept in the refrigerator to a child who's living in a homeless shelter where they can't go home till 6 o'clock at night.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Okay, so you and Ray really developed the Child Abuse Clinic. Right?
Yes.
And you had state funding for a while?
Early on, I think Ray had some kind of a contract with Protective Services. I don't think any of my salary came from that, but I think he had some kind of a contract with them. And Susan Scheuer, at fairly early point, I don't know exactly when, came up to do an elective with Ray from her medical school. I think she was going to the University of Indiana.
Yep.
And she came as a fourth-year medical student to do an elective in child abuse.
Okay.
And then she became a resident. And she had a special interest in that.
Right.
And eventually took over from Ray doing that clinic. Now, that was probably in the late 70s by the time that happened. And then Peggy Bailey, who was one of my psychology interns, who then became the pediatric psychologist at Ingham, was involved with that team. And we did get we got some federal money, I think, to do incest. That was another thing. When I was in training, incest was considered to be extremely rare. And I remember during my internship having two cases in my small caseload where there was incest in the family, and I thought, wow, this is amazing, you know, how peculiar. Well, of course, turned out it wasn't that rare.
Right.
You know, you just keep listening to people telling you their story, and you begin to hear it a lot. So it was just barely breaking the consciousness of anybody in the mid-70s, and so we did develop a relationship with Protective Services where they were going to send us the sexual abuse cases, because they didn't know what to do with them either. I mean, everybody was trying to figure out how to do the assessments, what to do, how do you talk to people about this. I remember Susan having to go in and interview a father who was an alleged perpetrator, and she put on her white coat. Nobody wears white coats usually in pediatrics, but she felt like she needed this symbol of authority to go in and talk to this father, you know. And then I remember her coming out into the conference room, and we would meet and talk about the families, and she said, I didn't need that white coat. I don't think she ever used it again.
Okay. Did you work with Don Duquette at all? Remember Don?
Yes. He was involved also with child abuse, but I don't think he was in the department very long. It was maybe three years?
I think a year.
A year.
Yeah, maybe two.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so yes, I did have some involvement with him, but it was short.
Yeah. For the record, Don Duquette was a lawyer.
Yes.
Who joined our department for a year or two.
Yes, and then he went down to the University of Michigan and established the family law clinic.
Right.
Yeah. Became quite prominent in the field of family law, which again was a new concept at that time.
Yeah. And he's another example of sort of the fun we were able to have in
the early
years.
That's right. That's right. That, you know, things were sort of free-flowing.
Yeah.
Another new venture that occurred in the early years was the establishment of a neonatal intensive care unit.
Right.
That was something new. And Tom Helmrath, who was a neonatologist in our department, set that up at Sparrow Hospital. And one of the things that we did in the early days was make ethics rounds.
That's right.
You, did you participate in that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we had them at St. Lawrence.
Okay, but we used to do this in the... Okay. Yes, we did do them at St. Lawrence, but these were specifically in the NICU.
Okay, no, I wasn't part of that.
Okay. So there was some period of time, I don't remember whether it was a year or longer, where we would walk around and look at these babies in the incubators, these very sick babies, and then go into a conference room and talk about, you know, what care is appropriate, what should, how should these decisions be made, how do you involve the parents in making decisions when things are fairly complicated and technical and they will have perhaps difficulty understanding really what the long-term implications are of this or that decision. And I respected Tom tremendously for his willingness to really be up front in wrestling with those issues instead of avoiding them or sweeping them under the rug or saying, well, this is the physician's decision, which was very, very common at that time.
Yeah.
But that was changing. It was changing, but, it, you know, there was a real respect for parents. And I remember that we involved some people from the Department of Philosophy in this. And again, that was the early seeds of the medical ethics program. There wasn't any medical ethics program. There wasn't any medical humanities program. But there were these early involvements that eventually led to those things.
And there was a medical student named Howard Brody.
Yes.
Who we gave an assistantship to.
Yes.
Who was doing also a PhD in philosophy at the time.
Yes. I remember, one thing I remember from when Howard Brody was a student was I was grading papers for the human biology and behavior course. And we had a short essay question of some kind. You know, and you know you grade all these essays, you try to set up some criteria for how to grade them.
Yeah.
And when I came to his essay, it was so much better than all the other essays. So I like, I have to revise my whole grading scale here. It was just, it was just distinctive in being way above everything else.
I remember having a student who kept saying to me, none of the social science stuff is at all relevant. I don't see why you have to learn it, blah, blah, blah. So I said, okay. And he was really objecting to the topic of the paper. I said, all right, write me a paper on why this stuff isn't relevant. It blew his mind. He didn't know quite what to do.
That's interesting.
And he ended up going into psychiatry.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
You know, in the early days of focal problems, one of the focal problems that we had was on ambiguous genitalia.
I remember that.
And that was, of course, a fascinating one to pick. Later it got dropped.
Yeah.
But it does give you the opportunity to really think deeply about some very, very complicated issues, which have proved to be even more complicated as history has evolved. And one of the students who was in the focal problem, and that was one where Art Corman and I were paired to teach together, so we had a really good time. And one of the students in that group, I happened to run into in his third year. And he stopped me and he said, remember that focal problems group where we did ambiguous genitalia? And I said, yes. And he said, I remember thinking at the time, he was a first year student, this is, you know, why would they be wasting our time with this? This is so rare. I'll probably never see this in my career. He said, on my OB-Gen rotation, I saw two in the first week. He said, I was so grateful to have had that preparation that I had a chance to think about this beforehand. He said, I felt like I could handle that whole situation so much better. And I just want to thank you because at the time I just thought, well, this is a bunch of hooey. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that I think you probably experienced, as I did, with a lot of the teaching that we did, that sometimes it was appreciated by the students at the time, but a lot of times there was sort of a delayed response.
Right.
And you'd see people later on who'd say, wow.
In the clinical years, they'd come back and say, I see why you want me to learn this stuff.
Yes, that's right. And I think that's why they then decided to try to have more clinical involvement with the students early on with mm-hmm. families
yeah.
at an earlier point in their training so that they could begin to see this, that ultimately if you can do the science, then the science becomes the easy part.
Yes.
and I've heard that from so many physicians, that when you're out in practice, it's really the interpersonal stuff, right. the family issues, all the psychosocial stuff becomes the most challenging mm-hmm. thing. Mm-hmm. Because to diagnose and treat, otitis media or whatever it
That's
is,
easy.
It's just not really that hard. Yeah.
Okay. Were you involved in the formation of the residency?
I'm sure I went to a lot of meetings, David. I was always going to meetings, so yes, I must have been.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a little vague in my mind, but I sure remember some of those early residents.
Some of them still in town.
Yes.
Tell me, when you joined the department, did they talk to you about doing scholarly activities?
Yes, but in a vague way.
Okay.
I don't think it was emphasized as much as it is nowadays.
Yeah.
I didn't have a grant. I didn't mm-hmm. have a program. There was nothing to kind of latch onto, and it didn't seem to be the central focus of the department. And medical education was clearly the central focus of the department. Even patient care activity was seen as something you needed to do in order to have decent medical education.
Right.
So, I was hired very much first as a teacher. I did have my own patients.
Okay.
Even before the clinical center was built, I used to see them in my academic office because mm-hmm. there wasn't another space to do it in. And that was sometimes complicated. Well, because, when you're a child psychologist, you sometimes see rather rowdy children.
Yes.
But once the clinical center was mm-hmm. built, then I was able to have a space to see them over there.
So then you developed the pediatric psychology internship.
Yes. Yes, and a piece of that was I needed to have more help with all the clinical things mm-hmm. that were starting to happen, that as we were evolving a residency and attendant clinical services, inpatient too, which was another thing. We ran all over town to three hospitals mm-hmm. doing psychosocial rounds at three hospitals. My goodness. So we were busy, and there was a lot to do and to cover, and I just really couldn't do all of that.
Yeah.
John McKinney, who had previously been involved in the department, mm-hmm. Had gone on sabbatical and decided to take a clinical internship and mm-hmm. to retread as a clinical psychologist, even though his initial training was as a developmental psychologist, but apparently he had taken all the coursework to do clinical, but he hadn't done the clinical, supervised clinical experience. So he went out to Seattle and taught in their psychiatry residency at the same time that he was doing an internship.
Good.
And so when he came back, actually while he was out there, he came back for a visit, and we recruited him, I think it was half-time, to be half-time in our department so that I could have more help mm-hmm. and we could have students to supervise, because you've got to have more than one supervisor if you're going to have interns. So initially we started it, I think, the year that John came back from that sabbatical. And he and I were the two supervisors. And initially it was what they used to call a captive internship. It was just MSU students who would do a half-time position with us during their doctoral studies.
Yep.
So they physically were already located here, and they would have a certain number of half days a week that they would come and do clinical work under our supervision. So then they were able to do some of the clinical things that we had been doing, make rounds with residents, for example, in the hospital, go to the clinics at St. Lawrence, round in the child abuse clinic, and plus have their own patients.
Right.
Then over time that evolved to the point where we really needed to make it a full-time internship. Mm-hmm. And partly that had to do with a shift in national policy of the American Psychological Association, which really wanted to move to the full-time model. Mm-hmm. And so in order for MSU to keep its graduate program accredited, they needed their students to go to accredited internship programs. Okay. And APA didn't accredit part-time internships. So our source for students began to dry up.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, if we wanted to have any interns, we would have to move to a full-time model and right. do a more of a national recruitment, which is what we eventually did. One piece of that along the way was that Bob Knoll was one of our half-time interns okay. early on. And when he did his rotation in the oncology clinic with Roshni Kulkarni, and I think Jovi Scott was there right. at that time, and I think Renuka.
I think Renuka.
Yeah. Or she might have been a resident at that mm-hmm. point. Anyway, he never rotated out, essentially. You know, years later, I would hear him giving talks about how he got involved with
yeah.
pediatric oncology, and he would say, you know, I did this rotation as an intern, and then I just never rotated uh-huh. out. But it's true. When his rotation was yeah. over, he came to me, and he said, you know, I really love doing this work mm-hmm. with children with cancer, and I think it would be good for continuity for the children. Rather than yeah. to rotate out, I would like to just stay mm-hmm. there during the rest of the internship year. It was hard for me to argue with that. Our program yeah. wasn't that formalized at that point anyway. So I said, sure, you know, if you want to do that. And, of course, the physicians were very happy with him. And then he had another year of coursework, and he stayed for an additional year in the oncology clinic, during which he wasn't officially an intern, and we didn't pay him.
Oh, okay.
He just volunteered his services. Yeah. And of course, that would include inpatient. Also, when those mm-hmm. patients got hospitalized, he would see them in the hospital. And it really was wonderful continuity for those children yeah. and families to have one person that was the person they were always working with on the psychological side.
And then we hired him.
And then we hired him. Exactly. Yeah. So, yes, it was very sad for us when he left.
Yeah.
It was wonderful working with him. But he's since risen to prominence in the field of mm-hmm. pediatric psychology, and he's done a lot of research on mm-hmm. the psychological effects of having a chronic yeah. illness on a child. That's primarily his area of publication. And he started it mm-hmm. with children with cancer, and mm-hmm. then he expanded it to hemophilia and sickle cell disease and rheumatoid arthritis right. and all sorts of other diseases.
Yeah. Where else did your interns go?
When they left,
yes.
the majority of them went to private practices, mm-hmm. but some of them went to university positions or to hospital positions, mm-hmm. But more clinical type positions okay. in pediatric psychology. Some of them didn't become pediatric psychologists. Mm-hmm. I had one intern who after, this is one of the early half-time interns, mm-hmm. who after spending a year doing this said, you know what, after this year I've decided I don't want to work with children. I'm not good at it and yeah. I don't like it. Okay, well, then that's a good yeah. thing to find out.
That's right.
But later on when we had the full-time program, we were getting people who already had decided that that was their career yeah. path. And most of them went on to continue working in the field of pediatric psychology.
Okay.
And even the ones in private practice usually tried to at least have part of their career be with a hospital uh-huh. or doing some teaching or doing some other kinds of things like that.
How was the program supported?
Program was supported through the department. Because interns come very, very cheap,
mm-hmm.
the department was able to afford it on the fringes of various things. Part of the time, especially once we became more involved with inpatient yeah. services, Sparrow Hospital put up mm-hmm. part of the money for the program. But we never had a great deal of funding. It's always hard to fund internships. And the way that a lot of times they are funded mm-hmm. is they're funded out of clinical money
yeah.
that you generate. But there's a catch-22 involved with that because you can't. There are restrictions on what you can bill for people that aren't licensed.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, since they're trainees, they're not licensed.
Right.
And those rules began to tighten up more and more so that we couldn't. In the early days, you could bill in the supervisor's name
right.
for work done by the intern, and that was perfectly legal. Later on, it got tougher and tougher to do that. Another way that people fund intern positions a lot of times is by contracts with agencies.
Mm-hmm.
I never really wanted to go that route because I didn't think it would be a good training experience
right.
to fill them up with a whole caseload of all abuse cases, for example,
mm-hmm.
which is the type of thing that often happens. A lot of times when internships are located at hospitals, they are just in the hospital
yep.
overhead cost because, again, the funding level is pretty low mm-hmm. compared to what everything else costs and compared to the benefit you get from
yeah.
it.
So what happened to the internship?
Well, eventually it was closed because of lack of funds.
Mm-hmm.
And this was after it had won a national award.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go back to some of your other clinical work.
Mm-hmm.
You worked with Ray.
Mm-hmm.
Did you work with other people in clinics?
Mm-hmm. I continued to work in the genetics clinic for quite a few years. So I did get to work with Saroj and Jim in the genetics clinic, and also Janice Lindstrom, who was an adult neurologist who worked in our genetics clinic for a while. In the pediatric clinics at St. Lawrence, you know, the general peds clinics that we had, I worked with whoever the supervising physician was and the resident. So Fred Matthews was down there. I don't remember who all was down there, but pretty much whoever was a general pediatrician in our department spent some time there. When I came back from a sabbatical in 85, 86, I think when I came back from there, then I was approached by Barb Desquin, who had been one of our students and then one of our residents, and then was hired as a general pediatrician on the faculty to do a chronic illness clinic, which was a niche she had identified for families of children that have complex illnesses that cross more than one subspecialty area. The problem is nobody's coordinating the care.
Right.
If you have something wrong with your heart and your neurological system and your kidneys, you know, people tend to divide up into all those pieces.
Yep.
And the general pediatrician really doesn't have the time to coordinate it. And then usually you've got special education and you may have other social services and you've got physical therapy and maybe speech therapy and all of this going on. So she had identified that as an area of special interest and wanted to start a clinic doing that and asked me if I would join in that effort. And then Jane Turner joined us in that effort as well. And that was a wonderful experience. I really enjoyed doing that very much. And it's interesting that that was also stressful, but in a different way than the child abuse clinic had been. For the most part, these were families that were very caring and able to care for their children. A little different than maybe some of the abusive families, but the needs were quite overwhelming. And the medical side was very, very complex. So I learned a lot more medicine in that clinic, and I learned a lot more about all the other services that these families get, and special education and the difficulties of coordinating and so on. So really, one of the things that I always liked is that whenever I did something clinical, I was always learning something new. It was a lot of fun having a physical therapist in that clinic. That's the only clinic I worked in that ever I worked closely with a physical therapist, and that was Dawn Welch. And I learned a lot from her. I also worked closely with a dietitian who most of the time in that clinic was Peggy Crum. And a lot of times she and I would do joint interviews with the families because eating is about nutrition, but it's also about behavior. And it falls very nicely, you know, sort of between the cracks, if you will, or across the boundaries of those disciplines. And so I learned a lot of interesting things from her about how to do interviews, asking questions that I had never thought of before. My favorite one was when she said to a family, "Do you have a table that you usually eat at?" And I thought, wow, what a great question. I never thought of asking that question. But that's a fundamental question if you're going to understand what a family is doing when they're having a problem around mealtimes. Do you have a table that you usually eat at? Two parts to that question. Is there a table and do you eat at it? A lot of families don't sit down to meals together. And I didn't even realize that, I think, until I started working closely with Peggy. So, always learning something.
And what happened to that clinic? Again, how was that clinic funded?
How was that clinic funded? Well, I mean, we were all the faculty people just decided to use our time that way. So, since our salaries were already being paid, we just
did that.
You know, there wasn't so much direction from above that you had to do this or that. It was more like, okay, that's what you're doing, fine. How Peggy and Dawn, people like that, were paid, I'm not really clear because I you know, I didn't retain the budgetary details,
yeah.
but I mean, obviously we paid them, but where the money came from, I don't know. And that clinic went on for quite a few years. And when Barb left the department and we needed a second pediatrician on the team, we had a number of people. Mark Israel for a while did that, and then Bill did it.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember being impressed that Bill found it overwhelming initially,
mm-hmm.
just like we all had initially.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, you know, here's the most experienced person I know
yeah.
also says, wow, this is exhausting. This is a lot.
Mm-hmm.
That was somehow very affirming because I had already evolved to a different place
yeah.
where it seemed more normal to me
mm-hmm.
by the time Bill joined. And, of course, I had great respect for him, and so that made me feel extra good about what I was doing. And, of course, Bill really is very, very interested in that and has retained that interest.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Run through the chairman for me.
Well, Bill was chairman when I joined.
Bill Weil.
Uh-huh. And then...
What was he like as chair?
Well... He was, I think he was very egalitarian in his approach to being chair. He was not a dictatorial person at all. But he always had a very strong point of view. So he wasn't laissez-faire either.
Right.
However, he firmly believed in faculty rights and faculty involvement.
Mm-hmm.
And so he anything that was going on that might affect the faculty, he would bring, and I think we had meetings every week.
Yes, we did.
That were vigorous
mm-hmm.
in character. There was a lot of discussion and argumentation, but it was all with good feeling.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't the kind of argumentation where people are, you know, personalizing or
yep.
angry. It was really about whatever the topic was. And the faculty at that time when Bill was chair were pretty... united, I think, in our value system, in that this was a faculty that was very concerned with social issues and social justice
mm-hmm.
issues. So it made it easier because we all had these shared values to disagree with each other
right.
because it was just a question of what was the best way of reaching
mm-hmm.
our shared goal. It wasn't a question of different goals.
Mm-hmm.
I think later there began to be more of a feeling of divergence among the faculty as other people were hired in who maybe didn't share that same
yeah.
sort of sense of mission that we had early on. So I think Bill was decisive. He knew how to get things done. He was very opinionated. And I don't necessarily mean that in a negative way. He just
yeah.
had strong opinions.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that
so
he
did the rest, most of the rest
so
of
us. So did the rest of us, right. And then that was okay.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really very nice. That was a good experience.
Did you go to subspecialty rounds at Ingham? Speaking of strong opinions.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I did. That we didn't have that right in the beginning. That developed later.
With the residency. No, before the residency.
Did it start before the residency?
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah the that type of intellectual engagement
mm-hmm.
around stuff really didn't bother me. I know that we had other faculty members who felt that it was too vigorous,
yes.
but... You know, with rare exceptions, I didn't think it was ad hominem. It was, you know, I disagree about
yeah.
the way this case ought to be handled.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that was interesting to me, you know, as a psychologist, I'm interested in human behavior. So wherever I go, I can observe human behavior. And it was fascinating to see how people from different specialties, and talk about subspecialty rounds, then the
mm-hmm.
focus was more on different specialties,
yeah.
how each person... really saw that patient from the point of view of the needs
mm-hmm.
of their specialty. So, you know, if your organ of interest is the lungs, then you're going to be very prejudiced in favor of how important lungs are. And if your organ of interest is kidneys, then you're going to think kidneys
mm-hmm.
are very important. And you could really see how the patient could benefit from that kind of vigorous discussion. The only problem is if people's egos got in the way,
yeah.
that maybe they couldn't really take in all the information. So that was sometimes a problem. But somebody over at Ingham in those early days that I thought very highly of was Tom Reed. Remember him? He was the intensivist.
Yes.
The initial intensive care
yes.
unit for
Ingham.
Pediatrics was at Ingham. And he was in charge of that
mm-hmm.
unit. And he was somebody who really could do that very well. He
yep.
could engage very well in the intellectual debate without getting his feelings hurt or personalizing anything. He could just take it all with a grain of salt, take it all under consideration, and then make a clinical decision. And I remember one of the things he was fond of telling the residents was they'd be making rounds on this or that patient, discussing this or that patient. And he'd say, well, this isn't in your big fat books, which is really an important recognition. Medicine is always evolving, and there's always going to be stuff that's not in the books. And yet there it is, and you have to deal with it. Yeah, I don't know where he went. He was only here a short time, but he was very good.
I don't... Somehow up north comes to mind.
Could be.
Yeah. Okay, so after Bill was...
I think... Wasn't Mike Bailey a temporary chair for a year or so?
Maybe.
I think
Ray was acting chair for a year.
Yes. I thought that Mike Bailey became chair, and then it was Ray after that.
That might have been the year I was on sabbatical.
I think I was on sabbatical, too.
Okay.
No. And then Ray became chair.
Acting chair.
Was he just acting chair for a couple years?
A year, maybe. A year? I don't know. You know, time gets vague.
Yeah. And then did Marshall come after that?
Yes. Then Marshall. Then they hired Marshall. Don Weston hired Marshall.
Okay.
Without consulting the department.
Oh, I don't remember that. I remember having Marshall and Phyllis to dinner at my house during the recruitment.
Okay.
And I remember actually what we served because they were so impressed by it. Marshall was an interesting man. I think he didn't connect well with the department. I liked him a lot, and I was familiar with his research. I already knew him before this. I had been down to Cleveland and, you know, visited what he and John Kennel, when they were working together, involving the parents more in the neonatal intensive care unit. When Tom Helmrath was... starting our NICU, a group of us made a visit down to Cleveland, and we met him then.
Okay.
And I was very familiar with his research and very impressed with what he and John had done. And so I saw him as somebody who was very friendly to psychological viewpoints. And so I did not have a problem with Marshall being hired at all because... You know, again, as a psychologist, my concern with any new chair would be, are we going to get somebody who's hostile to the whole notion of social science, which is always a possibility? So I was pretty happy with Marshall. I think Marshall didn't connect with the politics of this place well, and that was the problem that he had. But I thought he was a very nice man. I thought he was very concerned about faculty development. I think I got some bad advice from him, which I followed.
What was that?
At that time, I was becoming more involved nationally with pediatric psychology, which had become a sub-area of psychology. When I started out, there really wasn't any such thing as pediatric psychology. It was just really beginning. It was a group of, it was more of an interest group. We didn't have a journal yet, for example.
Okay.
We didn't have a division of APA, which we later got. We were just a group of people among the clinical child psychologists who kind of hung around in hospitals.
Okay.
So we'd go to national meetings, we'd seek each other out, and we'd chat, and, you know, what are you doing, and what have you found about this, and at that kind of level. And it had evolved into a society, and I was running for some office or other, and Marshall said, don't spend your time doing that. That's just politics. Don't get involved with that. So he really didn't want me to get involved at a national level with the Society of Pediatric Psychology. And so I did back off that. I didn't go to as many meetings, and I didn't participate as much as I might. So I know a lot of the people that are sort of the grandparent people. I mean, they're my age of that society, but I didn't get as involved as I was inclined to. And I think that it would have been better for my career if I had done that. But oh well. He wanted me to do research. But I had problems in that I wasn't in a department that was in my field. So, you know, getting research money is tough.
Yeah.
And then even when the interdisciplinary research money began to come out, it was always stipulated that it had to be across departments.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and like, we were across departments.
We were already in the same department, and yet in order to get this grant, you had to have somebody from different departments.
Yep.
And so that was always a disadvantage.
Problem.
So I was involved in writing some grants. Mm-hmm. I wasn't terribly successful at getting any grants. And I didn't have a research mentor who was in my field in the department. You know, so that never became a strong part of my career.
Mark Marshall was very careful with money. And when I became editor of the Clinical Sociology Review, I knew I'd need some department funds,
mm-hmm.
primarily for Xeroxing and postage and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
I knew Marshall wouldn't want to give it to me.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing Marshall wanted less was for me to ask the dean for it. So I went to Marshall and I said, Marshall, I've accepted this job. It's going to cost some money. I thought I'd go to the dean and ask him for some support.
Uh-huh.
And he said, oh no, the department will do it.
Well, that's good. And I think actually that probably has something to do with his saying I shouldn't get involved on a national level, because I think it was in a discussion of whether the department would support my airfare to go to meetings.
Yep.
So that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And Marshall and Gene Dolansky didn't get along.
Yes, that was a terrible problem. Gene Dolansky, I don't know what all those issues were, but I know that he had trouble getting along with a number of people.
Yes.
He was a kind of an angry guy. Do you remember that department retreat that we had when Britt Robillard was in the department? This was, I was pregnant, so I can tell you when it was. It was 1975.
Five.
It was June 1975. We went to a place called St. Mary's Lake.
Yes.
And had this weekend, I guess, retreat. It was over at least one night, maybe two. And part of it was in the evening, after dinner, we were going to sit down and have some kind of discussion of what, I don't know exactly how that was focused and whether it was situated about a question or if it was an open discussion or whatever it was. Bill was still chair during this time. And Britt was going to tape it because Britt was interested in nonverbals and communication and all of that aspect of behavior. And so he taped the discussion of the meeting that we had. And then the next day, in the morning, I think, he played back segments of it for us to discuss. And I recall Gene getting very angry because Britt was pointing out some of the things that were happening with Gene's behavior that were on the tape. And Gene got furious about that. Gene always felt kind of persecuted. I remember having a conversation with him about how he had grown up in a neighborhood where he was made fun of as a Polak. This was a thing that he received, those ethnic slurs. And I think that he had that sort of defensive feeling toward what other people were trying to do to him that carried over into his adult life in various ways. So he was... Again, he's somebody that I never had a particular problem with, but there isn't any reason that I would have.
I always got along well with him, and I did some little studies in the NICU that he helped, and I did an evaluation of the follow-up clinic for him.
Well, that's another thing I was involved in, was the follow-up clinic.
Okay.
Tom Helmrath, when he had set up the NICU, within a year or so, he said, we need to follow up. What's happening with these children, and we need to not just follow them medically, we need to follow them developmentally, because we know that we're saving lives of babies who either came too soon or had some kind of a congenital problem. So these are children that are at higher risk for a developmental disability. And so we set up a clinic where we would evaluate at certain ages, and I don't remember what all the ages were, maybe 3 months, nine months, and 18 months, something like that, how the children were doing developmentally. And that was set up as a multidisciplinary team clinic. And I used to do some of the evaluations. We bought the Bailey kit for assessing infant development. And we had a social worker, somebody from the hospital. I think Des was involved at some point with that. And I think there was a physical therapist, mm-hmm. probably a speech therapist, I don't know. And there may have been different people at different follow-up times, but...
Somebody from the Department of Education.
That's what happened then after the first year or so. Yep. Again, this became something that... It was too many patients.
Yeah.
And how do you do all this? So we were able to involve people from the Ingham Intermediate School District in doing the follow-up. And the psychologist from the Ingham Intermediate School District actually took over those evaluations. I think it might have been Jim Coleman, or it might have been somebody else.
I don't remember.
Anyway, so I backed out of that, but I was involved in setting it up initially and setting up what the protocol would be for what testing would be done and so on. Yeah, and then, of course, later on, the whole early on program
came out of
from the feds. But we were really ahead of the curve on that. We already had more going on here before it was mandated at a federal level.
You know, Tom Helmer once said, you know, the thing about this place is you're walking down the hall and you're thinking of where you're going, and all of a sudden there's a vacuum and you're sucked into it and end up doing something totally different.
This is true. And really, you know, we were all so, let's do this.
Yeah.
You know, let's put on a play. Oh, let's have a clinic to do this. Okay, that sounds like fun. It was so open.
Yeah.
It was an opportunity to follow whatever was fun, whatever would be interesting, whatever somebody else might be interested in.
Let's write our own textbook.
Oh, yes, that's right. Somewhere I probably, or maybe I've thrown it out by now. Mm-hmm. I did throw out a lot of stuff when I cleaned out my office. Yeah, that's right. We were going to write our own textbook.
Let's write a grant where we'll take over the whole university.
Well, Bill did have that idea that really every department ought to be under human development because every department was part of human development.
And we did put together some kind of a grant where we were going to get involved in undergrad teaching.
Huh. That's interesting. And what was the idea?
You start teaching human development early so that young people get an idea of how people develop. And that should help the developmental process. Troska was involved in that, too.
That's interesting. I did some undergraduate teaching from time to time as a guest lecturer.
Okay.
You know, somebody would, like John McKinney, who was still in the psychology department, would ask me to come over and give a lecture on pediatric psychology. That was fun. But I found that once I had really learned how to teach medical students, it was hard for me to talk to undergraduates because I didn't connect with where they were coming from. You know, I'd been out of that world too long.
John asked me to come over and talk about sex behavior in his adolescent class.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So we had Marshall as chair. And then I'm blanking on his name. Our geneticist. Endocrinologist.
Oh, Mike Netzloff.
Mike
Netzloff.
Yes.
That's right. Oh, dear Mike. You know, that was a sad chapter because all of us really liked Mike very well as a colleague. And when he became our chair, it was just a bad fit for him. Some of the characteristics that make him a very good endocrinologist and dysmorphologist, which is tremendous attention to detail, really backfired in the role of chair.
Yeah.
Mike could not see the forest for the trees. He was too attuned to details, and he was too afraid of letting go when he delegated anything. Mm-hmm. So he'd delegate something, and then he'd micromanage it. This drove everyone crazy. So that did not work out well for him to be a chair. That was really a shame. And it really ruined his relationships with a lot of people in the department with whom he'd had fine relationships before.
Yeah.
It was really a question of a bad fit for that role. He's great to work with clinically.
And he would also chair at a time when the department was going through annual negative incrementals.
And that's always very, very hard.
Which made decision-making much more difficult.
Mm-hmm. And increases anxiety.
Yes.
So if you're a person who tends to detail, the more anxious you are, the more you will focus on details.
Right.
So there must have been quite a magnification of that effect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So were you involved in his being persuaded to step down?
Yes, because it was all the full professors,
yep.
and I was a full professor by then. I think there were six or seven of
mm-hmm.
us.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that we had a meeting. It seems to me it was at Don Kaufman's old house.
Or quite possibly.
Before they moved to Lake Lansing.
Yeah.
And I think you were there. Danny Murray,
yeah.
Don, Bill, Jim. And me, maybe Jim Higgins. I don't know if he had left and gone to Grand Rapids by then. I'm not sure when
no,
that happened.
No,
he hadn't
no.
so much. And yeah. That was painful.
And there were consequences to that which came from the dean's office.
I think that Steve Zopf was assigned to us.
Well, yeah. But also, the senior faculty was then excluded from the department decision making.
Oh, that's interesting. See, I don't recall that.
Okay.
Maybe I wasn't even aware of it. It's possible.
It's possible because,
yeah.
you know, so then he was succeeded by Al Sparrow.
Mm-hmm. Now, at what point in that sequence did Weston stop being dean?
Weston appointed Marshall. I think that Bill Abbott appointed Mike Metzloff.
Okay. Because I was also involved at the college level with that transition
okay.
between Weston and Abbott, because I was chair of the College Advisory Council
okay.
at the time of that transition. Right. And so a lot of my energy during that period of time was at the college political level
yep.
rather than at the department level, because we had
mm-hmm.
this crisis over this problematic faculty member, you recall,
yes.
who had been hired despite a previous problem,
mm-hmm.
and apparently the provost had not been informed, at least that was the version of the story that
right.
we ended up with, that the provost had not been informed of this person's past history
mm-hmm.
by the dean, but the dean knew about it.
Right.
And that resulted in the resignation of the dean.
The forced resignation.
Yes.
Yes.
And
an attempt by the provost to take tenure away from the faculty member.
Yes.
Which did not succeed.
Did not succeed, right. And I don't know how that finally played out, but I do know that that person left
yep.
the university a couple of years later,
mm-hmm.
presumably with a large monetary settlement, and later left the community. But we then had to have an acting dean
mm-hmm.
in that transition, and that acting dean became Bill Abbott,
right.
who had been Weston's right-hand man for managing all the details.
Yep.
Uh-huh. He wasn't the big picture guy, but he was the detail guy.
Mm-hmm.
He knew all about the contract negotiations with hospitals. He knew all about, you know, what was happening in all the different
right.
communities and all
right.
that stuff.
Right.
And then after that, of course, immediately a search went on for a new dean. So I was very involved with all of that stuff, and that took a lot of my energy away from departmental concerns during that
yep.
period of time. So that would have been at the time that Marshall was still chair? Is that when that happened? I don't recall.
I think so.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
It could be. Do you know another thing about Marshall? Do you remember that Marshall had me run the faculty meetings at the department level?
Yes. Yeah.
After, I don't remember how long this took, but after the first few months, he came to me and he said, you know, I'd like to be able to speak up more at faculty meetings. And if I'm running the meeting, I feel like I shouldn't speak.
Yeah.
And you know how to run a good meeting. Why don't you run the meetings for me? So I did. That meant I had to go to all the meetings and be on time, too.
And Marshall was one of the people who was upset by the definitiveness with which opinions would get stated, both in faculty meeting and at subspecialty meetings.
It's interesting. You know, I almost wonder whether there's a cultural piece to some of that, too, in that if you think about the early core faculty, many of us were Jewish. And there is a very strong Jewish tradition of vigorous argumentation. That's a very Jewish enterprise. You know, that saying, two Jews, three opinions. You know, you're supposed to vigorously argue about things.
That's right.
You're supposed to wrestle with the Torah.
Because there is no right.
That's right. There is no right. And no one can ever know. And so you must always argue. In fact, I remember that a graduate student who was an Orthodox rabbi came here and was a student of my husband's. And the faculty, who were not Jewish, thought he was psychotic because he, you know, somebody would begin a lecture and he'd say, how can you say that when over here it says this? Well, from his yeshiva education, that was an appropriate thing to do. And they didn't know what to do with this extremely intelligent person whose behavior seemed to them, in the Midwestern context, so inappropriate. And so they went to Art saying, well, maybe you can do something, because they always used him for difficult students. He was always known to do well with difficult students. And he actually trained this person about the cultural context and what was expected here and how that was not what was expected in this context. So I wonder if that even was part of it, that there was that Jewish context of, okay, let's have a good argument. We'll all be very vociferous and then we'll all go out and have lunch together and be pals. You know, and Marshall was not Jewish. And so, you know, that...
And Seroj was not Jewish.
Seroj was not Jewish. So some of the people that were uncomfortable with this, it may have been a cultural context.
Okay. We had a resident, a DO resident.
Oh, yes, Kaufman.
Steve Kaufman.
Yes, Steve Kaufman.
Who was a good Jewish boy from New York.
Yes.
And had many of the same abrasive characteristics. And most of the people at Sparrow said, that's the trouble with DOs.
Yes. Yeah, it is. It is a quite a strong cultural piece.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay, where were we?
Okay, so we have Micah's chair. And then we had this terrible period where Ray was going to be chair, but Ray died.
Oh, is that when that happened?
Yeah.
God, that was so sad. Yeah. And then I remember we were casting about for who could be chair. Now, we always did these external searches, and we never got any of these external people. And it seems like we were always missing somebody by a hair who would take another job. And you may really know more about all that than I.
Dennis Murray was acting chair for 2 or 3 months.
Okay.
And he laid down the law to Abbott saying, you know, I don't want to continue as acting chair. Either I'm a real candidate to be chair or I'm resigning as acting chair. And Abbott said, we're going to do an outside search. You're not a real candidate for chair. So Dennis stepped down as chair. At which time Abbott made me convener of the executive committee. He wouldn't even name me as acting chair.
Ah. Because you weren't a physician?
And because I'd been involved in helping Mike to step down and who knows why.
Well, I always thought Abbott was very sensitive to the non-physician issue himself, and therefore would no way have made a non-physician chair of a medical department.
And so then Al was appointed as acting chair.
Okay.
And I, at the time, I thought appointing Al as acting chair was a good move because Al was basically kind and basically not very driven.
And he didn't have any other big projects going on. It seems to me one of the reasons that he got appointed was because most of the other potential candidates were really very, very busy doing things.
Yeah.
And he was not as busy as other people. So it seemed like he could actually fit it into his schedule.
Yes, yes. And so then, a couple of years later, there was a big national search. And there was a guy from Connecticut.
Yeah.
Who strung us along and strung us along and strung us along. He was a big poncho in primary care.
Yes.
And he strung us along till he got a huge, improved appointment at Connecticut. And at some point then there was the Cuban.
Yes. Yes.
Who came.
He was a cardiologist, I think.
I don't know what he was. Maybe.
Yeah. And I thought he was actually going to become chair, and then something happened at the last minute, wasn't it?
Yes, he got a better job in Miami.
Oh, well.
And V. Weil said, you know, V. Weil was being a real estate agent at the time.
That's right.
And she said, well, I knew he wasn't going to come because I showed him all these houses and he wasn't interested.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Okay. There was a guy from Cleveland who was possibly an infectious disease. He was a subspecialist, friend of Ashir's, who I thought would have made an excellent chair, partly because he talked to me about, well, you know, I understand you're doing all these good things in the sociology journals, but why aren't you publishing in the medical journals?
Uh-huh.
You know, and I thought, gee, this guy's going to shape the department up.
Uh-huh.
And the dean had no interest in him.
Huh, that's interesting.
So the guy from Connecticut would say, well, in another week I'll know, and Al, the dean would say to Al, well, you're going to have to wait a week before I know where you are. And I think Al wanted to become permanent chair so badly that he let the dean treat him very badly.
Mm-hmm.
And then Al became the permanent chair.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And Al had the opposite problem to Mike, which was he didn't pay enough attention to details.
Yes.
He didn't know what was going on. He didn't remember what he'd said. He promised people things and then later seemed to be completely unaware of having said it, so then people would get very angry and accuse him of being a liar. I'm not sure he was a liar. I think he didn't pay attention.
Yeah.
So it was sort of classic, you know, go overboard in the other direction.
Right.
And that became a real problem when the financial crunch came down because he didn't know what was happening with the numbers at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like the financial person didn't either. I remember going to a meeting when we were having a lot of extra meetings about finances and being really shocked when I opened my folder that had what we'd said at the last meeting and neither Al nor Steve Zoff had a folder. They didn't bring any paperwork and they didn't have the numbers in their heads.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, this is impossible. You can't run a department this way.
Yeah.
You don't know what the budget is, and you haven't kept track of what we've said about it.
And Al wouldn't delegate.
Yeah.
That was the other thing. He wouldn't get any of the senior faculty to assist him. But I always felt that some of that came out of the dean's office.
It could be.
Maybe just my paranoia.
Wow. It's a shame.
Yeah.
It's interesting that Bill never was interested in taking back the chairmanship again.
He'd done it. He'd used up. But once Bill said to me, you only have power when you don't have to use it. And as soon as you have to use it, you use it up.
That's interesting.
And by the time he retired from the chairmanship, he'd used it up.
Well, I think the days in which he was chair were really the you know, the sort of glory days of the department. That those were the early days when there was so much excitement going on of building something new and creating something new.
And a rising budget curve.
Yes.
Never underestimate the power of a rising budget.
Yes, yes. That certainly helps one's optimism.
So, Betty, as you look back as you're on your career in the department, what were the highlights?
Well, I think having a significant role in creating a medical school where the psychosocial component was important and really eventually did become very well integrated into the curriculum. Doing some important work on affirmative action, which we really didn't talk about.
We'll talk about it.
I was involved very early on, again, when the term affirmative action was really brand new, and maybe even before it was coined, I don't know. But in the early 70s, when we had this four-year medical school, and we were doing recruitment, I was on the admissions committee, and Judy Krupka was the head of admissions. She was the director of admissions. And we were very interested in making sure that we recruited a good cross-section of students, including underserved minority representation. And so we did a number of things to try to make sure that we built that into the admission process. And also women, of course, naturally I was very interested in recruitment and retention of women medical students. And there were a lot of barriers for women in the early days. Interestingly, you didn't have to do anything special in terms of tweaking admissions with grades or MCAT scores, because there were plenty of women that were qualified on grades and MCAT scores. What you primarily had to do was not create a hostile environment for them once they got here. And so the issues with women had a lot more to do with helping the faculty, particularly some of the older male faculty, who had a different mindset and were, you know, unmindful of some of what they were doing. I mean, we had issues with the girly slides being shown in OB-GYN lectures. I remember having an issue with the OB-GYN textbook. The cover showed Eve being cast out of the Garden of Eden. That was the artwork on the cover of the OB-GYN textbook book. And, you know, I pointed this out to whoever was the chair at that time, Kirschbaum, who did not appreciate hearing this sort of thing from me. And, you know, say, this is inappropriate. You need to complain to the publisher or choose a different textbook. What is the message here? You know, woman is having pain in childbirth because of original sin. Please, this is terrible. there were no bathrooms for the women when they went to the hospitals as medical students. And they wanted to go to the bathroom. They had to either use a nurse's bathroom or a patient bathroom or a public bathroom. There were no doctor's bathrooms that students could use in many of the community hospitals. There was a similar problem with locker rooms. And I remember hearing from women students that were on surgery clerkships, not in every hospital, but remember, we were in six communities. Yep. So there was a lot of variability, and particularly further away from East Lansing. That it was not uncommon for the surgeon to give an impromptu discussion of the surgery, which they had just been involved in the locker room as they were changing out of their scrubs. Mm. The women couldn't be part of that. And the surgeons had no conscious realization that they were cutting women out of part of the education. So I was an informal support person for a lot of the women medical students and residents early on.
Yep.
Before we had more women faculty, there were very few women faculty early on. And so, I mean, they weren't patients of mine. I didn't have them in psychotherapy, but they would just informally drop in on me. And it got to be almost a joke at one point among the women students that if somebody was seen in my office, it's like, oh, God, I didn't know she was having a problem. But there was a lot of stuff like that. I remember one of the students who later became a psychiatrist who was very concerned about the quality of experience that a child was having in the hospital. And that was a big issue, again, that we didn't really talk about in this interview. But one of the early issues that I was very involved in professionally was the whole notion of what kind of an experience emotionally is a child having in a medical setting, particularly the inpatient setting. How can we really do more to make sure we're not damaging children emotionally while we're helping them physically? Things like lying to children was very, very common.
Yeah.
It was really the norm. I mean, adults were also lied to. If you think about what things were like in 1971, people routinely lied to patients with cancer, for example. Nobody ever had cancer. Everybody always had something else.
Yeah.
This was something that Elizabeth Kubler Ross talked about, and I went to quite a few of her lectures and had a reception for her at my house, actually, at one point when I was first doing work in oncology.
Yeah.
And learning about this, I worked with Terry Hattie. And at that time, we were on a national protocol, and this was for treatment of leukemia.
Yeah.
And the children that we were seeing, when they broke the code, we had the worst protocol. Virtually, they almost all died. It was awful. And, you know, how do you talk to the families? How do you support the families? And one of the big things was lying. How do we talk to a family and a child honestly about cancer? And one of the big barriers was breaking down the notion that you can't say these words to a child, because people didn't have a realization that those words don't have the same meaning for a child.
Yep.
You know, so you'd have this room full of people in tears, and the family would say, "Well, don't tell my child."
Yep.
You know, so they'd be making up fairy tales about how the child had anemia. And then the child would be asking the night nurse, "Am I going to die?
Yeah.
What's happening to me?" And the night nurse would be saying, "Oh my goodness, I don't know what's happening here."
Mm-hmm.
The night nurse would be disconnected anyway from the rounds. And that was one of the big issues when we would make psychosocial rounds, is how can we have them at a time that the night nursing staff, because they weren't doing 12s at that time, they were doing 8, so there'd be three shifts of 8. And so you'd have somebody that was really never present during morning rounds except to give their nursing report and leave. They never talked to the physician. So they didn't know what was going on in terms of what was the family being told, what was the child being told, and you used to have these awful situations. So a lot of the stuff that I did early on was really to work not just with physicians but with hospital staff too, about how we have to find a way to be honest with children without being brutal to them. And even such straightforward things as saying, "This isn't going to hurt," when you're going to do something that's going to
hurt.
You don't do that. Because you teach people to be afraid of medical care and to be mistrustful. The other thing was allowing parents to stay overnight. That was, remember this? This was a very early fight. It was a big fight.
I remember the big flap after they decided that the mother could stay overnight. A young couple from someplace from out of town, they both wanted to stay in the kids' room.
Of course. So that, you know, that I was very proud of really being part of the movement to make medical care more humane for children and families, and not for children to be separated, young children to be separated from their mothers and their families when they had to stay in the hospital overnight, particularly for prolonged stays, because all the hospital stays were longer than they are now.
Right.
This was before all of these, you know,
all the outpatient stuff.
How you can't stay longer because insurance won't pay for it, kind of thing. That all came in later. So children used to stay in the hospital to convalesce too. They used to be riding tricycles up and down the halls. The stays were much longer. Now, you know, you're booted out the minute you can breathe on your own, practically.
They used to stay in the hospital long enough to be a problem to the resident.
That's right. So that was something I was proud of, working with the women students. A woman student told me this instance. She had been working with a child who was going to be having some procedure. She was on her pediatric rotation. The child was going to be having, let's say it was a spinal tap, don't know, something like this. And she had developed a relationship with this child and wanted to be there to support him during this procedure. And so she had checked with whoever was going to be doing that about when this would be taking place before she left the floor to go have lunch or whatever she was doing. And then when she came back, it had been done in her absence. And she was just furious, because it was very important to her, and she would have worked her schedule around to be there for this child. And when she expressed herself to the attending, who had done this procedure without regard to this, he said, you know, you ought to be a mother. You're better suited to be a mother than to be a physician. You know, so this was the type of thing that was not at all uncommon for women medical students to be subjected to in those days. So I did a lot with that. A lot also with women residents when we had a residency about trying to help residents get some kind of maternity leave rights that would enable them to take time off, and also paternity rights. I really, this never made it, but I worked hard to try to get our residency to offer an elective in the care of the newborn, which people could use to stay home with their own child. And I really thought
not enough supervision, buddy.
Well, I was willing to supervise part of it, and there were some other people that were too, but it never got off the ground. I thought it would have been a fantastic elective.
Not enough public behavior.
Yeah, but it's so true for, you know, for men and women. Yeah. Having your own child is an education that's
right.
different from anything else, and it's an important and valuable education for a pediatrician. I was just on the phone last night with our son Jacob, whose wife is going to be delivering sometime soon, and he was telling me that they had gone to a class last weekend taught by a pediatrician who told, and it was care of the newborn, you know? And the pediatrician, whose wife is a developmental psychologist, told this class, you know, it's different. What you learn by having a baby and taking care of that baby yourself. He said, I'm a pediatrician. I'd given lots of advice to parents. My wife's a developmental psychologist. We've been giving lots of advice to people. But yet when we found ourselves at home with a newborn, there we were in the middle of the night with a crying baby. Didn't want to eat. Didn't have a wet diaper. Couldn't figure out what's wrong. You know, this is a different thing. It doesn't matter how much everybody tells you. You know, having a baby is an experience unlike any other, and you will learn things that you can't learn any other way. And, you know, that was my point in trying to develop the elective, but it never got off the ground. But there was a lot of socialization that had occurred of the physicians, particularly the older they were, in their own training, where it was kind of like fraternity hazing. I mean, really, being a medical student and a medical resident was very much like joining a fraternity. It was all guys, and it was all, let's all show how tough we can be and how much we can take it and not have a personal life, work long hours, you know, be up all night, get up the next morning and without any sleep, work all day. And, you know, we're still dealing with this. You know, the culture still hasn't evolved to figure out how not to abuse residents and with rising cost of medical care.
I had a neighbor when I lived in Baltimore who was a medical student, and he was married. He had a very difficult time finding a residency where they would pay him a stipend so he could rent an apartment instead of having him live
in the hospital.
That's right.
And in the old days, this was before my time, but I heard about this from older women physicians. They used to, if you were actually a woman, which was rare, you were expected to have an abortion should you become pregnant during your residency. There was no maternity leave. I mean, it's really horrifying. So I really did a lot to try to support these young women coming up because they needed somebody to stand up for them and to help them.
Yep.
And to get them in groups, that's the other thing. So it's not one student against this male faculty.
Yeah.
But groups of students can have a more effective voice. A single student can be scapegoated. And then eventually they did establish a chapter of the American Women's Medical Association and so on. But early on, there wasn't any of that going on.
And we had a higher proportion of women medical students than most medical students.
Yes, we did, because we did discriminate against them
when
we admitted them. And again, the minority students, the same thing, really actively seeking out minority students, and then again supporting them once they were here, because they also experienced discrimination, oftentimes unconscious. And a lot of times they would have a different cultural background that meant that the references that were being used in the education, which weren't specifically medical, were not known to them.
Yeah.
And this was an eye-opener to me, not even realizing that some of the kind of middle-class white experience that you bring, and then you think, well, here's a common example from everyday life that you can use, wasn't a common example from everyday life.
Like, who's Winnie the Pooh?
Yeah. Or, you know, a character in the musical Carousel. I remember a student bringing that up because apparently it was a question on, maybe it was on the MCAT, I don't know, it was on some sort of a national test at something about Carousel, musical Carousel, and the student said, "What? You know, I don't know anything about this. What's this got to do with me?" Well, at that moment in time, that would have been pretty general information for a lot of people, but it was culturally specific, and it was a poor choice to include in a national exam like that. So, yeah, that was something that I was proud of. The child abuse work I was proud of. Ray and I really worked together to try to raise consciousness of physicians around here not to advocate spanking, for example, because, you know, even though a little patch on the bottom isn't the end of the world, when you use a term like spanking, it there's a way in which that gives permission to people that are really beating their children to say this is culturally normative, and that physicians don't necessarily have that in their consciousness when they support the idea of corporal punishment. And getting a child protection law. There was no child protection law early on with mandatory reporting. And that was something that we worked on. And the mandatory reporting, I remember being a big issue for therapists and physicians. Like, well, it'll ruin your relationship with a patient. Yeah. And Ray argued successfully, and I think quite rightly, no, this is actually a protection for us professionally. If we are not mandated to report, and if we don't have sanctions against us for failing to report, then it's going to be too hard for us to do it because we have a relationship with the patient.
Yeah.
We have to be able to say to a patient, I don't have a choice. I must report this, but I will continue to be your physician, and I will help you through this process. That was really, really important for that to happen. And I still feel that today when I have to make a report, you know, because I still see patients. Sometimes I do have to make a report, and I feel the support of that law when I say to somebody, you understand that I will have to make a report, and this is what will happen, and I will support you through this process, and we can continue to work together. But if I have any suspicion of child abuse, I must make a report. So that's something I'm proud of. And then the whole internship is something I'm very proud of. You know, I'm still in touch with many of the interns. I get baby announcements from them and Christmas cards and emails. Yeah. And, of course, when they change jobs, a lot of times they need to get some paperwork from me certifying that they did complete the internship. So that helps me keep track of them. I see them at professional meetings. And they have wonderful things to say about what a wonderful learning experience that was for them. Not only in the variety of the experience that they had, and we really were able to provide them with a very rich variety of different ages of patients, different sorts of patients from different kinds of families and different backgrounds, different diseases, plus, you know, sort of standard mental health outpatient, you know, kids that didn't have medical issues, but also working in a family context, which I came to value very much. And we didn't talk about that, but during the early part of the medical school, Cy and Marcia Warby and Lucy Ferguson from the psychology department were developing what they called the Family Life Clinic over in the Department of Psychiatry, but it was really interdisciplinary. And I was involved sort of in a consultant role, but also that was another educational thing. We would get together and have cases that we would discuss. And I think you might have gone to some of that, too.
Yeah, I went to some of those.
And so it was Lou Snow. I mean, they cast a broad net in terms of trying to make that multidisciplinary and involve a wide range of people. And that became a source of students for our internship also that had been through that training came to us. And then when Kathy Seitz joined our faculty, we had somebody who was really a family therapist to be a supervisor. And I took additional training over the years in family therapy. Because the original way that I was trained was you dealt with mothers and children. And it's like, father, who's that?
Yes.
which really makes no sense. In fact, at Cleveland, which was an analytic, a psychoanalytic model, I remember seeing children, and a social worker would see the mother, and I would see the child mm-hmm. in separate hours. Well, that, you know, there are times that that may be useful,
yeah,
but it's not good for that to be the only model.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even today, you know, seeing the whole family, meeting everybody in the family, mm-hmm. at least the first session, then you might decide to see other people. Mm-hmm. It's incredibly useful. I remember one of the interns one time having done this, and this was something we always had to help our interns learn to do because they're not usually trained that way elsewhere. So you make a big effort to get this whole extended family, whoever's involved with the
yep.
child's life, you know, the index child. And this intern had gotten it, let's say it was a blended family, so there were kids from a couple of different marriages and maybe a kid or two from the present marriage. And the intern said, "This was fascinating." He said, "I would have never known this if I hadn't had the whole family there."
Mm-hmm.
But actually, the child who was referred as being the problem child was not the most problematic child in that room. It was a different child. But the other child was the mother's biological child, and the child identified as the problem was her stepchild. So, you know, there were a lot
yep.
of family dynamics just evident in that first
yep.
meeting.
Yep.
So providing that kind of training for students mm-hmm. where they felt very supported by the faculty while they were in a stressful internship.
Yep.
And we did ask
mm-hmm.
a lot of them. They were on call. They took night and weekend
mm-hmm.
call. They had to deal with children who were dying. Sometimes we had some very dramatic incidents with that. I remember one particular intern who was present when a child was being discharged. This was a child with leukemia who was being discharged from the hospital after her hospital stay to go home, and she suddenly began to bleed and she just bled out and died right there. And, you know, this is not something people usually see in
That's
a psychology
right.
internship.
Yeah.
So, you know, we had to, in order to ask our interns to do this kind of work, we had to be very supportive
yeah.
as a faculty, and we always did tell them, you know, "I'd rather have you call me
mm-hmm.
if something scary or bad is happening than to have you sit with your anxiety for two
yep.
or 3 days until the next scheduled supervision time."
Mm-hmm.
So it meant the supervisors were always on call to our interns as well. You know, if there was abuse, suspected abuse,
mm-hmm.
if there was a big medical situation, if there was suicide, and of course we did all the suicide evaluations
mm-hmm.
for all the inpatients at Sparrow, the children and adolescents. So it meant a lot to provide them with that kind of background, because I think it's extremely important to be able to do this kind of work to give that kind of support.
When your interns left, those who went on to work in medical settings,
mm-hmm.
did they hit culture shock from being treated differently?
Yes. Yes, they did. You know, and not even so much by physicians, although that happened,
mm-hmm.
but a lot of times by other psychologists.
Mm.
You know, they would be surprised to go somewhere and find that their supervisors in their new location, because a lot of times they go and do a postdoc somewhere, didn't participate as equals with the physicians the way that we did.
Yeah.
You know, we were never afraid to be with our physician
yep.
colleagues and say, you know, "I have a different idea about this.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it may be better to approach it this way," or whatever. And that was respected and listened to. In fact, it was sought out. I remember one of the interns telling me this marvelous story about it. He just happened to be walking through clinic. I don't know, he was
mm-hmm.
going to do some paperwork or something. And one of the physicians, it was Jovi, kind of grabbed him and said, "Oh, will you come and sit with me? I need to give a family a diagnosis, and I'd love to have you present." And, you know, he was going to give bad news to a family. And
yeah.
so he grabbed the psychology
uh-huh.
intern. The intern sat in on the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Jovi apparently did a beautiful job. The intern, by his report to me, never said a word. And later, Jovi thanked him for being there. So, you know, it was just the feeling of support. Again,
yeah.
of there's another person here.
Right.
And in case this goes in a direction that
okay.
I feel uncomfortable with, I know that I've got somebody here who can
yeah.
help me handle it.
Yeah.
And just all you had to do was just be present. And, you know, that kind of real openness and willingness and
yeah.
showing the interns even at a training level that they were valued members of the team. Yes, that was something that people didn't always find when they went elsewhere. But I think it helped them create that in some of the places that they went. So, yeah.
Any final words?
Final words.
Any objections about the faculty meeting in the men's room across from your office?
Yeah, that was all part of that early sexism stuff. You know, I think one of the things that we didn't talk about this time that we talked about when we did the previous interview that didn't turn out well on the tape was the whole smoking thing. Do you remember that in our early faculty meetings? Quite a few people smoked.
Yes.
I didn't, but most of the men smoked. I don't know whether they all did. Al never smoked.
No. Ray didn't smoke.
Ray didn't smoke.
Bill and but I you. And...
Mike Bailey, Mike Tom Bailey. Helmrath.
Yep. And we smoked pipes.
Yes. David Klein. Yeah. Jim Higgins, I don't think, smoked. And Joe, I don't remember Jim Trosko smoking, although maybe he did. Anyway, I never liked smoking. I've always been a big non-smoking fanatic. And when I was pregnant, I came to the faculty meeting and said to all of you, well, okay, folks, I'm pregnant, and I would really appreciate it if you didn't smoke in faculty meetings, because I'd really rather not breathe it. And again, this is before there was really any data to speak of about secondhand smoke. And everybody agreed. Mm-hmm. It was really very nice. It was very supportive to me. You know, and then I went on to continue to campaign for non-smoking meetings and offices and so on. And eventually that did become university policy. And then I remember going to a college faculty meeting where the signs were newly posted, no smoking, in the life sciences auditorium where the faculty meeting was being held. And Don Weston, who was still dean at the time, was smoking, I think, a pipe, but it might have been a cigar.
I think it was a pipe.
Anyway, I raised my hand and said, excuse me, are we going to be following the Board of Trustees ruling that there's no smoking in this room? And he said, sit in the back. I was so mad. So I left, and I didn't go to a faculty meeting for a college faculty meeting for a long time after that.
Didn't miss anything.
I'm sure I didn't. Yeah. I actually freed up some time.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was another one of those early battles that, you know, later on you kind of forget what a big battle it was, like allowing mothers to stay overnight, and like trying to raise awareness of child abuse and how to ask questions about that mark on the child and all of those things.
I remember there was a fight so that the pediatric nurses could wear pastel blouses instead of white blouses.
Was there?
Yes.
I missed that one. Yeah. But I do remember that change of shift. You walked into that little conference room in the hospital after change of shift, you couldn't breathe because all the nurses were smoking. And that's all changed, too. I mean, it's hard to even imagine that in today's context, but it was very common.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Great.
Yes.
Well, thank you.
It's fun to reminisce.